From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made Tuesday night during the first of what is normally three presidential debates. I say normally because after the fiasco seen by more than 70 million people on Tuesday, there have been calls to cancel future debates between former Vice President Joe Biden and the President Donald Trump. During the 90-plus minute debate, candidates argued, derailed into personal attacks. If we're being honest here, it was pretty much the president trying to run over every answer, every question, at one point even saying to Chris Wallace that maybe he should be moderating. The president thinks he should have been. According to the tally by the Washington Post, Trump was responsible for more than 75% of the interruptions. Seeking, without success, to get things under control, Wallace at one point said to Trump, quote, "I think that the country would be better served if we allowed both people to speak with fewer interruptions. I am appealing to you, sir, to do that," end quote. For all of its unproductiveness, the debate itself was the subject of debate on social media. Audience members and media professionals have argued if the next two debates should be handled differently or canceled altogether. One of the calls for cancellation comes from Atlantic Monthly staff writer David Graham, who late Tuesday night wrote a piece titled "Cancel the Debates," saying, quote, "The event was a shambolic shout fest with scarcely a single morsel of substance to be found," end quote. Meanwhile, the Commission on Presidential Debates says it plans to make changes to the format for the next two. It said one of those changes could be allowing a candidate's microphone to be cut off if they are violating the rules. So what do you think? Should we have two more debates like this? Will making changes ensure a substantive or even just a watchable discussion? Our guests will discuss these questions and more this hour. Welcome to the program, Kim Smith, a statewide organizer for Vocal New York. Kim, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan. Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Maya Komisarczyk is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Rochester. Maya, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And welcome to a former aide in the Obama White House. That's Alex Udelson. Alex, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
I thought about cutting some sound for this, but I think we all had enough on Tuesday. I mean, I don't know that we need to relive that. Given what we experienced, Kim, I'll start with you. Should we do two more of these things?
We absolutely should. Not following that same format, we certainly need some rules, like the rule about cutting the mics, but there needs to be a rule on cutting the mic. But I do absolutely believe that we should not cancel the debates. These debates have been a part of our democratic process for more than 60 years. They allow us as voters to analyze our choices. As the candidates answer questions, we can gauge how we feel, what we want, and which best suits our needs. So we need these debates. What we don't need are the ego-driven, self-centered pissing contest that happened the other night. That was more about Trump's ego and need to control and dominate the discussion than it was about the citizens and the issues that impact us.
Alex Udelson, two more of these?
Yeah, I mean, this is a tough one for me because I agree with a lot of what's been said in that there wasn't a ton of value as it relates to people's lives, to policy. But I think, you know, a debate is a contrast of two candidates. And as ugly as it was, the contrast was shown. And so to the extent that there are undecided voters out there, which at this point in the presidency is a phenomenon that I don't quite understand. But to the extent that there are people that are genuinely trying to figure out how to vote in November, I do think it's important that the president is exposed in this sort of forum where he doesn't just control the format, the method, the questions, the reporters, the answers. I think it's thrown him off his game to the extent that he has a game. And it's important that voters have every last chance to understand, you know, their choices going into the poll. So as much as it would pain me to watch two more of those, I do think that they're necessary.
Okay. Professor Komisarczyk, what do you think?
The conventional wisdom on debates in political science is that they don't have a lot of effect on the outcomes, if that's kind of the way we're measuring whether we think we should have these, whether they're really informing voters. And the intuition underlying that is that you know, people have by and large already made up their minds by the time that they tune in to watch. So the real effect on voters, however it makes us feel, is that, you know, for the people who are engaged in politics, this is just a kind of reinforcement of the partisan commitments that we have that are very deeply ingrained and very, very hard to change. In fact, our perceptions of what happens during the debate as we watch it are heavily influenced by the preconceptions that we come in with. So for that population of kind of undecided voters, which is, you know, just kind of subtracting out that people have declared they're voting for Trump and voting for Biden or intend to in November from, you know, like the RCP average is something like 7% of people. The thing to remember about that group of people is that they're also the least likely group of people to be watching, to be engaged in politics, to be kind of exposed to this forum for guiding their decisions along. So if we want to think about what the value of debates themselves as opposed to other forms that campaigns use to access voters, it's hard to think about what the debate itself is doing to change minds as opposed to some of the other activities that candidates are going to engage in.
Was that, Professor, was what we saw on Tuesday, did it feel historically bad because of just everything feels extreme with recency bias, or was that historically bad?
So I think it was historically bad in terms of its sort of uncouthness, disrespect for the rules of the debate institution itself in a very asymmetric way, obviously. But in terms of, did we learn much less about candidates than we usually do? Was there some revelation about their positions on policies or issues that we, you know, didn't get that we typically get? It's not clear that that's actually degraded anyway, right? It's just this kind of flagrant disrespect for discourse, for being tethered to a form of truth is what kind of felt unusual about it.
Yeah. And listeners, I mean, to Alex's point, it's hard for some voters to imagine that some of their fellow voters would still be undecided, but there are some who are undecided. I would love, if there is anyone listening right now who is undecided, to call this program, 844-295-TALK. That probably means the phone won't ring all hour. 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994, or email us, connections@WXXI.org. Of course, we'll take calls from you if you're not undecided, but if you've got thoughts to share on whether we should have two or more of these debates. But, you know, Alex Udelson, when we think about the kind of the historic nature of debates, everybody loves to say, you know, Lincoln Douglas, we're not really going to do Lincoln Douglas again, though I do want to ask a semi-serious question. I had a suggestion from a listener this morning that both of the candidates should come out on stage, they should put them in soundproof chambers for 90 minutes, and they should be given a series of essay questions. And they should be disconnected from communicating with anyone else, and they've got 90 minutes to answer in essay form, and then they can come out and read their answers one by one. You know, I actually, in a weird way, sort of like that, because I'd like to see how people think in depth and at length, and not just when they're trying to score points, or how many prepackaged zingers do you have, what's the strategy of interrupting. And I'm not both-sidesing this. I mean, this was a one-sided problem on Tuesday night, but I don't know if we should try to get more actual substance into it, or if we should just give up on that. Do we talk about Lincoln Douglas too much, or is there a format, Alex, that you see that could actually provide some substance?
Well, look, I mean, I think the idea of them sort of being in isolation from each other takes away from what a debate could bring about, right? So, you know, if you remember back in 2012 with Obama and Romney, Romney made these kind of absurd claims about what President Obama said about Benghazi, said that he, you know, didn't call it a terrorist attack. And, you know, the president said that he did, in fact, call it a terrorist attack. And Candy Crowley, who was the moderator, sort of chimed in and said, no, you know, Mitt, he did, in fact, call it a terrorist attack. And so a debate format like that, where there's a moderator that, you know, can get a word in and that can, you know, somewhat fact check a candidate, which Chris Wallace, I actually think, tried to do. He did it on healthcare a couple times. He told President Trump that his plan, you know, did in fact, you know, exclude people with pre-existing conditions. So the idea of there being a back and forth is sort of fundamental, not just to American politics, but, you know, every you know, sort of state has had that sort of forum of interaction in the way that they choose leaders and choose government. So, you know, I don't think you're going to glean a lot from a 90-minute essay from Donald Trump. I don't think there's going to be a lot of coherent thoughts there. But I think it's important that he is exposed in a forum where he can't just control the narrative. He can't just say whatever he wants. He can get fact-checked by a moderator. He can't talk over everybody. I think they need to mute the mics when it's not the candidate's turn. And frankly, had that happened, I think it could have been even more of a mess for him. So I think that back and forth, though, that interactiveness of a debate is important.
Okay. Kim, as I'm reading about the next formats here, we are going to see sort of a town hall style. We could see, quote unquote, average Americans or undecided Americans asking questions. Are you hopeful that we'll see any substance, Kim? Because I take the point that you and Alex are making. When you see contrast of just basic decency and human behavior, that can be valuable. But when it comes to actually understanding what someone may do in office, substantively, are you confident that we could see a different format that produces it, Kim?
I think if we have a moderator and if the commission sets clear rules, not only for the candidates and when they will turn the mics off, but very clear rules for the moderator on when to turn those mics off and when a person is not answering a question directly related to policy issues, then that would be an opportune time. But I also agree with what Alex was saying about having the two together going in that debate form, because for me, I like to see how the candidate handles conflict. And I think that is the way that the stage is set. It allows for the perfect opportunity for that.
Wow, we are flooded with phone calls. I'll get to that in a second. Alan in Pittsford says, just got a note from my sister in England who writes, oh dear, just watched a bit of the Trump-Biden debate. Not one of democracy's finest hours, more like an argument down at the pub. And Alan says, let's remember that the world is watching. Yeah, I think to Tom Nichols' point on Tuesday night, who is part of the Lincoln Project, who's been on this program, Tom says he thought bad night for the president, but also just a bad night for America. And the one point that they made in their sort of post-debate analysis that I thought was interesting, I don't like seeing audiences, live audiences at debates. And I'm glad that we're not seeing live audiences of whooping and hollering and things like that. But when it comes to what fuels certain responses, Nichols is saying that the president is sort of the ultimate candidate who's driven by what the audience is telling him. And there was no audience telling him either tone it down or kind of going crazy saying, yeah, let's, you know, whooping it up for him. And therefore, he was left sort of by his own instinct and never took his foot off the gas. Alex, do you think there's something to that? Do you think an audience changes the dynamic in a debate like this? Because I'm glad there's not an audience.
I'm definitely glad there's not an audience. I think an audience does change for a lot of people, but I don't think Donald Trump reacts to anybody. I don't think he's ever reacted to anybody. And frankly, I don't see, you know, Eric Trump sitting in the audience saying, you know, Dad, chill it out. You know, he'd be hooting and hollering and telling him to go further. So I don't think there's going to be any sort of mitigating factor for Trump other than turning his mic off or, you know, I think that's basically the only thing you can do short of tackling him. You know, I don't know what people expected Chris Wallace to do up there. So I'm definitely glad that there aren't audiences. You know, I think it plays into more of the emotions and less of the policy ideas, and we don't need half the room clapping for, you know, universal health care and half the room, you know, booing universal health care. That just doesn't help us as a country.
Yeah, I agree. Let me get Kasai in Rochester on the phone first. Go ahead, Kasai.
Hi, I'm from Rochester, and I'm trying to express my opinion on your assertion that the president is more aggressive on debate. And I feel like the president has been more defensive and being honest, because he's been, you know, multiple times told that to shut up. And I don't know why you have to, you know, take a side to the president.
You think Joe Biden was more aggressive in interrupting and sort of adding chaos on Tuesday night?
Yes.
No. No.
Okay, this is my opinion.
Yeah, but you're wrong. This is not something. This is not worth having an opinion on. I mean, like, this is not difficult. I mean, we have to be able to say squarely that one of the two candidates, he interrupted 76% of the time. I mean, way more than Biden. And at one point, Chris Wallace, who works for Fox News, told Trump, "You're the problem, dude." And Trump said, "How come you're not talking to Biden?" He says, "Because you're the one who's doing all the interrupting." Kasai, I'm not trying to be unfair to the president, but I don't know what that's not. You can still support the president and acknowledge that he was the one who added the chaos and the aggression and the interruptions. I mean, I don't know why. I'm very confused by this. I mean, like, I'm not saying you shouldn't support him. I'm saying that he was. Okay, go ahead.
It's not like I'm supporting the president or not supporting. I'm just talking about what American people deserve. When we see a debate, we want to see a policy expression from both sides so we can make a choice. That's my expectation.
Yes.
But when you see both guys are not matured. The president is not matured. Joe Biden is not matured. So in this case, I don't believe that the president did worse than Biden, because Biden showed immaturity by saying shut up. He said shut up. It's not something I'm making that up.
Okay, he did say that.
I am just a public. I would like to have a truth, you know, from the media. You should be independent enough to show the truth. Don't take a side when you're supposed to be independent.
Okay, I appreciate the call, and you're wrong. And I don't mean to be rude about this. I'm not trying to be condescending. We have to be able to talk about this directly. We have to. Kasai, 75% of the interrupting was one guy, and it was President Trump. That's a fact. That's not, well, you know, I need to say that they both did. Now, Joe Biden has said that he had a weak moment when he called him a clown. And when he said, shut up, he said, shut up in a kind of an exasperated way. When Trump continued to interrupt, and finally Biden said, "Will you just shut up, man?" I mean, it was a weak moment, and I'm not going to defend it. I'm not going to defend Biden using the word clown. I won't defend that. I'll let his supporters defend that if they want to. But this is not a case where there were two people behaving the same way. It's just not. Professor Komisarczyk, am I being? Is the media being unfair on this?
Oh, certainly not. I mean, the debate was pretty clear in terms of differences in behavior between the two candidates and of the substances of what they said. There's also the sort of false equivalence of extremes, right, in the sense that it is, while it's not a mature or saintly or zen thing to have told Trump to shut up on Biden's part, the other extreme was, you know, failing to condemn and actually giving an order to white supremacist organizations publicly. So if you want to weight these two things, given that they both happened, we certainly can't weight them equally without drastically distorting reality.
Okay, well, here is an email from a Trump supporter. Tim says, "Evan, as a regular listener to your show, and as you know, a vocal Trump supporter, I thought I would send you a quick note. The Trump-Biden debate was truly embarrassing for our nation. I was not surprised with Trump's constant talking over of Mr. Biden. I expected Trump to act poorly. Now, Biden, on the other hand, acted much more juvenile than I expected him to. Clearly, Mr. Trump helps bring out the worst in many people. Should we have more debates? Sure. But they should have their microphones cut off if they abuse the other fellow's time to respond. I recently watched the debate between McMurray and Jacobs. It was clearly a very good debate in which the viewer could clearly learn more about the candidates as well as see the personality of the debates. How other countries view the spectacle would be interesting to hear." Okay, so, Tim, I appreciate that. It is interesting to me to hear someone say, I'm a vocal Trump supporter and he brings out the worst in people. But, okay, Tim's assessment is that Biden was surprising in acting juvenile at times. Okay, I'm a little thrown off course by this. I'm sorry. A lot of talk. Here's an email from Chris saying, you got to be able to cut the mics. The Trump campaign will not agree to it. The debates have to be agreed to with the rules by both sides. Therefore, cancel the remaining debates. Kim, if we can't cut the mics, should we not do this at all?
Oh, we still need to do it.
We got
to
do it?
Yes, we absolutely need to do it. Because although I went in with very little expectations, I came into this debate with very little expectations, but I walked away with a confidence knowing that I will be voting for a man who can handle himself against the likes of Trump. So we absolutely need to have these.
Okay. Let me take another phone call. Just really surprised at that. Rich. Hi, Rich. Go ahead.
Hey, Evan. Just real quick. Like you said, the false equivocation. It's like someone saying to me, you know, that little kid who stole that candy bar from that store is just like Bonnie and Clyde. Please. The interesting thing I've noticed is that I've heard is that from all of my, and it's anecdotal, all of my Trump supporters said, I don't know who to vote for now. It was just so bad. Whereas the Biden supporter says, there's no way I can vote for Trump. So it seems to me there's still a level of justification on Trump supporters to support him. But my point was maybe make it a town hall, not a town hall, but a question answer for each one of them separately with very distinct questions from three different panelists, if you want to say left, right, center. Or even better, the idea of having soundproof rooms, but with today's audio systems, we can have each one of them in a soundproof room answering the questions and actually hearing what the other person says, but can only respond when the mic is on. So the other person has their 2 minutes, and if Trump wants to jump up and down in this glass soundproof room, let him do it. And when he has his 2 minutes, he can say whatever he wants. But you can't do mics on a stage. They're not far enough apart. That's a no starter right there. Unless you have distinct breaks of that sound, and you can only do it with soundproof rooms, turning off mics do nothing for you.
Okay. Rich, I appreciate that. You know, I mean, I don't know. There's not a lot of faith from listeners that things are going to change. I mean, there's Liz says, I think we should give the candidates one more opportunity to try again. But if it doesn't go well, scrap the third one. That we even need to cut the mics, which I agree we should, speaks volumes about what we currently have in terms of leadership. We should not change the paradigm for future candidates with the hope that this is a one-off. That's from Liz. If anything, Kim Smith, can we ditch the notion, you know, not that it's ever been serious, but it has been used as a slur. Can we ditch any, even the slur that women are too emotional to be president? What did we see on Tuesday? I mean, oh, my God.
I think they validated why we need a women president. And I cannot wait for the vice president debate for Kamala to show up and really speak to how this thing should be done.
Mm. Alex, do you think that this is a one-off? I mean, do you see future election years in which we can do this sort of civilly?
Yeah, I mean, two things. I mean, first, you know, the fact that we're having to bend over backwards to think of, you know, what sort of technological setup we can have for a debate between, you know, the president and his opponent is just ridiculous. All it is is that the president is a little petulant child who can't control himself and has no original thoughts. And so, no, I don't think this is going to, you know, assuming that if this is an anomaly in our politics, then I think that there is a chance that this can be an anomaly in our debates. I mean, you just have to go back to, I mean, frankly, even 2016. I mean, this is why he's gotten so unhinged lately. I mean, 2016, he was creepy, he was stalking, he was rude, he was racist, he was the, you know, his usual self. But he wasn't just screaming for an hour and a half. And then, you know, I love the, you know, the pearl clutching from some of these folks who are mad that Biden said shut up once, but are probably going to end up voting for the president that, you know, made fun of someone with a disability and, you know, thinks less of women and people of color. And, you know, the reason that they are, that folks are unsure about, you know, they say that they didn't like the president's performance, but, you know, they're unsure of who to vote for is because they like his, you know, whether it's his racist policies or, you know, his backwards tax plan that probably isn't going to even benefit them in the long run. I mean, we sort of on this debate and this election, we have to get real for a second and just note that we have hopefully what is an aberration of a president who behaves like a child and has terrible policies. And everybody needs to vote in the next month and end this so that we can have some semblance of normalcy in our lives.
Professor Komisarczyk, just briefly before I get a break, and then I'm going to bring in David Graham, who wrote the piece for The Atlantic called Cancel the Debates. But briefly, Professor, in the primaries, and I'm sure the New York Times and other media outlets will do this again, but I'm thinking of the times in the primaries when the Democrats had a big bunch of candidates. They had what I thought were phenomenally detailed interviews and then issue explainers on the candidates. So, for example, on climate change, the Times had these long, detailed profiles of every Democrat in the primary, every Republican 4 years ago, where they are on that issue. Where are they on, you know, economic issues like taxation? And I found myself going, oh, I really like how they're rolling this out. They're using multimedia platforms. They're putting it in the print edition. They're doing it on social media. And I could see and compare at length. I can see if the candidates can or can't speak at length on various issues. I like that stuff a lot more than I do seeing two people shouting at each other on stage. And again, I'm not trying to create a false equivalence, but I do wonder if we as an electorate are going to want something better than this format in the future. How do you see it, Professor?
So I mean, personally, I absolutely agree with you. They even, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post made these fantastic voting advice applications that help match you to the person who lives closest to you on these issues. And they were fantastic. But the thing you have to remember is, most voters are still getting their primary news and their primary source of learning about campaigns and candidates is TV. So these kinds of print and web applications are great, but they are not necessarily reaching everyone who is going to be thinking about voting and participating in elections. So there's going to have to be something, even if it's not a debate format, where, you know, I sort of agree there's a limit to how much learning that we can do about campaigns. And if we're talking about changing the entire set of institutions specifically for a candidate who has shown over and over again that he has no respect and no intention of abiding by any of the institutions, even in these little debates that are designed to constrain his behavior, you know, the question is, what can we put on TV where voters are actually placing their eyeballs to get information that is going to give them, you know, information they can use about how to vote that isn't this kind of format?
You're hearing Professor Maya Komisarczyk, a professor of political science at the University of Rochester. Kim Smith is with us, a statewide organizer for Vocal New York. Alex Udelson, a former aide in the Obama White House. And after our only break of the hour, we'll welcome David Graham from The Atlantic. That's all coming up on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, a conversation with candidates for state assembly, the incumbent Marjorie Burns, the challenger Sharon Sattler-LeBlanc. Then in our second hour, a conversation about mental health and care and culturally sensitive approaches, not just in light of the Daniel Prude case, but more. Talk with you on Friday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. A lot of feedback, like Wendy's email. Wendy says one solution to the inconsiderate behavior may be to put both candidates on Zoom. If there's an interruption, mute the interruption. That's what I would do in my virtual classroom. That's from Wendy, and about four other people have said do it on Zoom. I think the world needs less Zoom. I think we've had enough Zoom. I appreciate the sentiment behind it. I don't think we're going to see debates on Zoom. David Graham's a staff writer at The Atlantic who wrote a piece called Cancel the Debates. David, thanks for making time for the program. How are you?
Thank you for having me.
Let me read a little bit of what you wrote, and then let's talk about it. You write, although the primary debates are run by news outlets in coordination with the major political parties, the general election debates are hosted by the Commission on Presidential Debates, a nonpartisan independent body. The group aims to support a lofty ideal, and you quote it, The CPD's primary mission is to ensure, for the benefit of the American electorate, that general election debates are held every 4 years between and among the leading candidates for the offices of President and Vice President of the United States. The CPD was formed to ensure that the voting public has the opportunity to see the leading candidates debate during the general election campaign. And you conclude, if the CPD really wishes to benefit the American electorate, it should cancel the rest of the debate season. All of them, David, both of the remaining presidential and the vice presidential?
You know, some people have told me that they think it would be really valuable to see Kamala Harris debating Mike Pence. And having watched the debate between Pence and Kaine 4 years ago, that was a fairly informative and civil debate, if not the most exciting one. So I can see a case for that. But I'm having a hard time seeing the case for holding two more of these presidential debates.
Well, here's a couple of arguments in favor, and I'd like to get your take, and then we'll have other guests weigh in. First of all, our guests have been raising the point, Kim and Alex in particular, saying that, yes, it's fair to say that there was almost nothing of substance in terms of understanding policy or how someone might govern. But we certainly got to see temperament, maturity, basic decency, and those contrasts do matter. And at the very least, we can make some decisions based on those factors. Does that sway you?
Yeah, I mean, those contrasts do matter. I think that's certainly true. What I would say is first, we have had ample opportunity to see the character of both of these candidates. There's really quite a bit of material in both of their cases. I think we can see all of that without having to put ourselves through such an excruciating experience. Beyond that, you look at the numbers that watched this debate, and the numbers are down from past debates. And of the people who watched, almost all of them already made their minds up. So there's not a whole lot of decision making to offer here. There are obviously a few voters who are not decided and who are looking for more information. There's a fascinating story in Politico which covered a focus group held by Frank Luntz, longtime Republican pollster and opinion analyst. Talked to a bunch of undecided voters who really panned Trump's performance. They said that he was, among other things, unhinged and un-American, and also said they were still undecided. So if the purpose of the debate is to let people see that temperament and make a decision, I'm not sure it's even succeeding on that ground.
Well, how about this? Gilbert writes to the program to say, President Trump now holds no press conferences, so the debates provide a rare opportunity for journalists or citizens to question him and get him on the record. A useful result of yesterday's debate or Tuesday's debate was that we saw Trump's response to the white supremacy issue. That's definitely worth being brought to the wider national attention. What do you think, David?
Well, Trump is giving some press conferences, and he's speaking on a regular basis, ostensibly about COVID, although it tends to be about whatever is on his mind on a given day. He answers questions and gaggles from reporters. I think that white supremacy question was interesting, and it was an important moment for all of those reasons. On the other hand, we've had many chances for Trump to condemn white supremacy, and he has he's failed to do that in the past as well, repeatedly. So while it is striking and I think disturbing, it's not entirely new in that case either. We saw Chris Wallace interview Trump on Fox News Sunday a few weeks ago, and I thought that was a much more news-making interview than what we saw from the debate. And also it was a forum where Wallace had much more opportunity to challenge Trump and ask follow-ups. In the debate setting, it's really hard for any interviewer or any moderator to achieve that.
Yeah, I take that point on white supremacy, and maybe this is some of what Alex Udelson, a former Obama White House aide who's on the line with us, was saying earlier. Alex, you seem bemused that there are any undecided voters. And to David's point, Alex, if Tuesday was your first encounter with the president's flirtations and friendship and courting the support of white supremacy, then you just have not been paying attention. And further to David's point, if you watch that debate and you find yourself saying, I'm undecided, but the president acted un-American, unpresidential, in a bullying manner, but I'm still undecided, I don't really understand. I mean, does this sort of baffle you in the same way, Alex?
Well, it definitely baffles me, but I think there is still value in that being exposed in this sort of forum. Because if you think about it, if someone is saying, wow, that was really grotesque the way the president handled himself, he's a petulant child, but I'm still undecided, that means that there are some policy considerations that you have that are potentially overriding the fact that you've now acknowledged that the president is a child. And so for those people to have to sit through that two more times and really think, is it worth electing someone who is the laughingstock of the world, someone who is personally very dangerous to this country, just so I can have, you know, a tax plan that, like I said, probably in the end won't benefit someone who's watching, just so I can, you know, risk my niece or nephew not having health care. I mean, I think exposing the president to this sort of forum where he can't fully control the narrative, where he can't fully control the structure, the questions, the reporters, will hopefully give those people just a couple more instances of pause before they go into the voting booth and really make that decision about whether this is the direction you want to continue to send our country in for the next 4 years.
Kim, are you swayed at all by David's piece saying, you know, there just isn't anything new and there isn't anything good coming of this? On top of what I would add to David's concerns, Kim, that I do care that the world is watching this, as one of our listeners pointed out. And I do care about maybe the damage that is happening reputationally and just to institutions and the way people view decorum. But that doesn't seem to move you off the need to keep doing this, Kim.
It most certainly doesn't. David, I must say, I really enjoyed reading the piece. I just disagree. I think it's about more than just deciding on who to vote for, but it gives an understanding for the voters to understand what they are voting for when they show up and vote. What are the policies that are on the table? What's at stake? And what are the priorities? For example, in this moment, when we think about critical race theory that's based on race, law, and power, given everything that is going on in this nation, in this state, and even in our Rochester city, I needed to hear a conversation on how they will address law and order. Although it was a real crap show, I needed to hear and get somewhat of an understanding on that. So it's, again, I disagree, David, but I love the piece.
All right, Professor Komisarczyk, are you swayed at all? Go ahead.
Well, I mean, the piece is very much in line with the kind of wisdom on this in political science, that there is, you know, most people kind of know exactly what they want to do going in, and the effects of this are all just confirmatory of the expectations that we have. And I sort of added earlier that the folks who are undecided are also the folks who are least likely to be watching. The kind of two things that I'd probably add to the piece, which I broadly agree with, are the first thing to keep in mind is, you know, one big difference between the origin moment of the debates in 1960 and today was that candidates have so much more media access to voters than they did before, right? In the 1960s, a televised debate might have been, you know, the only piece of televised access you got to communicate with your opponent, to act as voters in the entire season, right? There'd be very few opportunities, but now candidates can post videos. They are followed around by news cameras 24 hours a day, all the time. And they have ample opportunity to make policy statements, to respond to things that their opponents have said. So that media cycle gives them much more expanded access to voters, and the unique contribution of a debate as opposed to something else is a lot less clear. And the kind of final thing I want to add is that, you know, for a lot of us, watching these debates sort of feels like participation, especially if we've already decided and we're mobilized and we sort of think that, you know, this is participating. But the thing to remember is that, you know, it's not enough if you know, particularly for those of us who are not already in organizations and we kind of watch these debates like they are sports. We need to, you know, organize and participate and call up our friends and donate money to causes that we think are important and get out there and actually organize and engage in political behavior on the ground and not kind of get sucked into watching this and thinking that this is the entire kind of experience.
My opinion on this is immaterial. I'm the host. I will say, I think David's piece at least gets me thinking, when do we as an American people become Kodak still trying to sell film when everyone else has gone digital and not realize there's better ways to do this? But I'm not sure we're there yet. And I've hosted and moderated many debates. It's not an easy job. I think Chris Wallace had a very hard job. I think he didn't try hard enough in the first half hour, but it wasn't easy. Let's rip through a bunch of your phone calls, and then we're going to get our guests to respond. Betsy in Brighton, next. Go ahead, Betsy.
Hi. I follow Heather Cox Richardson's blog. She's a historian professor in Boston. And she says frequently when Trump has one of these media tantrums, it's to create a smokescreen from other information that's going on or to distract people. So we have to remember that the New York Times has published two very large articles, two consecutive days, on his tax returns and manipulations that occur in his organization, and also that the coronavirus news is not getting better, that there's more people that are infected in Florida now that Ron DeSantis has opened up all the restaurants. The Midwest is also in a surge with record cases in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Kansas, as well as South Dakota. So, and also his former campaign manager, Brad Parscale, who was hospitalized for psychiatric evaluation, they're very concerned about him opening up to the nefarious operations and the White House. So a lot of times he does these things to distract the media from more salient issues, because as your prior speaker just said, a lot of these things we already know. We already know he's a white supremacist. We are, you know, so these are other things we need to look what's behind the screen, because he's frequently like the Wizard of Oz, you know, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
Betsy, thank you. I noticed there wasn't a whole lot of talk about the New York Times' tax story at the debate. There started to be, and then I don't even remember what distraction took it off course. Let me get Jay in Rochester next. Go ahead, Jay.
Hey, Evan. I kind of have to disagree with everyone that I actually do think it was a one-off. I think if there was a second debate, that Trump's attack will not be the same. I think this attack was completely premeditated. I think that they've been throwing out the narrative that Biden is either early stages dementia or full-blown dementia. Biden is also a stutterer, and one of the triggers for a stutter is to be interrupted time and time again. And I think the plan was to make Joe Biden look confused, to get angry, and be who they said that he actually, their story of who they say he is.
Okay.
I also think that there are three responses that Joe Biden could have had. One, he could have let it get to him, and they would have said, see, he's not capable of leading the country or holding the office. Two, he could have done nothing, and then they could have said, well, look it. He, you know, sitting across the table from Putin or from Erdogan or Xi or Kim Jong-un, he wouldn't be able to handle the attack. So his little throwbacks, I think, were the perfect response. They showed that he was together and that he's not going to be pushed around and bullied.
Jay, thank you. I guess we'll see. Apparently there will be at least one more debate if there is a different approach from the president in the next one. And let me grab Jane in Rochester as well. She's been waiting. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, Evan. Unlike the last two callers you had, I do believe probably that the Republicans don't want any more debates. Somewhere inside of these people that like Trump, they've got to realize that this is not a very stable together person. Can you imagine him talking to foreign leaders? I think that we're having more trouble maintaining friends now than we used to. And what does he go through when he talks to them? We don't know for the most part. I really believe we should have the debates, because I want to see everything I can and hear. And when you both see and hear, it may give you a different, you know, because we get the twittering all the time and not complete sentences and so forth. And as for the shut up, ooh, I could have done a whole lot better than just shut up. But I think Chris Wallace should have just said, shut up, but I know he couldn't do that. But maybe he has learned, you know, and will be tougher next time. But I think with Biden, enough was enough. Mm. Also, even though Trump, I don't know what the numbers are, how many times Trump interrupted to Biden, but when Trump interrupts, he filibusters, he rants, he gets off the subject. And Chris Wallace mentioned that. Well, let's get back to the subject. I don't know how many times he said that. And I think it's just simply so that Biden cannot speak. Also, Trump is not real good with the issues, you know. So he has to be in total control, and he's like a two-year-old that wants M&Ms. He's going to have a fit and make you miserable till you do as he wants. But thank you very, very much.
Well, thank you, Jane. Pat writes to say, I want my country back. How embarrassing for democracy. And by the way, people who say they are undecided say it just so they can get put on forums and featured on TV. No, I don't think so, Pat. I think there are some people who are still on the fence in this election. I think that's actually the case. But let me, as we get ready to wrap here, boy, this hour has gone fast. I want to ask all of our guests to weigh in on something that we haven't talked about yet that I think is very important. Toward the end of the debate on Tuesday night, once again, the President of the United States tried to cast doubt on the validity of this election. And I am deeply concerned just about the undermining of an institution like this. And that's one reason, David Graham, that I look at this and say, I don't know if we should keep doing this if he is going to keep trying to undermine trust and basically say, if I win, it's fair, and if I lose, it's unfair. That, to me, is very concerning, David. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And Trump has other forums through which he's done this, of course. But the debate really is an unusual forum for all of the reasons that all of us have been pointing out, including folks who argue that, you know, the debates are valuable. They are a special forum for that reason. But it gives them a chance to spread these things to a wide audience. And it's another place where I'm not sure that the benefit of the debate outweighs that that risk of him doing everything he can to cast the integrity of the system in doubt.
Kim, you're someone who's run for office. You're a statewide organizer for Vocal New York. And I know you know the importance of building trust in institutions. Does this concern you? If we keep having these national forums, these debates, and undermining the trust in institutions, does that worry you, Kim?
Not really. I don't think that we can allow, although he is the president, I do not think that we can allow him to control the narrative. My hope is that it is going to push our state and local offices to be more accountable and reassure people, really step up their processes and reassure voters that they are going to do everything in their power to make sure that this is a fair election and that every vote is counted. But I cannot see, even if we remove the debates, Trump would find a way to get that narrative out there, and we cannot allow him to control that.
All right, Professor Komisarczyk, are you concerned about the trust in institutions?
So, of course, I'm concerned about the underlying trust in institutions. I don't think the debate is a unique place to say that, because Trump has made overtures over and over again at the possibility of delay in the election or surveying friendly governors to see if they might stop counting or press on electors and things like that. And those things are very, very serious threats that people should be aware are possibilities and should be working as hard as they can on the ground to prevent, right, in real time. It's not a matter of his saying so in the debate, because, you know, Donald Trump will convey willingness to subvert literally any institution that exists if it means winning. But we have to be aware of that and take that seriously. It's not clear to me actually whether saying that in a debate is good or bad, to the extent that for the committed partisans on the other side, or really for anyone who still respects and deeply values and is attached to democratic institutions, my hope, you know, the possibility that their reaction is, you know, this can't stand, I'm even more motivated because the stakes are higher in this election than they ever have been for the future of democracy. And some of the early kind of survey results suggest that's the idea, whereas we sort of know his base is going to say, like, good, this is what we want, you know, victory at all costs. So the net effect, we don't know, but the information that, you know, this is seriously under consideration for this administration, they're willing to take these steps, they're not just blustering, we should take that very seriously. Yeah. And if people are aware that's out there, they should know that that's the case.
45 seconds, Alex Udelson. Are you concerned about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say, you know, with this election, that is what keeps me up the most at night. You know, I don't think anybody is even doubting at this point that we're probably going to win, that Biden is probably going to win the popular vote and hopefully the Electoral College. But you know, the sort of constitutional crisis that we're careening towards is deeply problematic. He's already begun to normalize among his own party and even some Democrats and independents the idea that the Supreme Court is somehow an arbiter in election results. And that is the reason explicitly why he is trying to push through this Supreme Court confirmation so fast. So I think this is one of the biggest issues, and the ability of Biden and the moderators to refute that is going to be critical in the next couple of debates.
Alex, thanks for making time for the program. Nice having you.
Thank you.
Professor Komisarczyk, great having you. Thanks for making time.
Thank you so much.
Kim Smith, let's talk again soon. Always appreciate it.
Thank you, Evan. Be well.
And David Graham's piece is called Cancel the Debates. You can read his regular writing on The Atlantic. Appreciate the time, David, and you and the team do great work there. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. And by the way, they are hard at work on tonight's forum, 8 p.m. on WXXI-TV and our various platforms. We will talk to you on Connections tomorrow on member-supported public radio.